Richard made another entry in his mental diary. Dear diary, he thought. Today I've survived walking the plank, the kiss of death, and a lecture on kicking. Right now, I'm on my way through a labyrinth with a mad bastard who came back from the dead, and a bodyguard who turned out to be a... whatever the opposite of a bodyguard is. I am so far out of my depth that... Metaphors failed him then. He had gone beyond the world of metaphor and simile into the place of things that are, and it was changing him. They were wading through a narrow passage of wet, marshy ground between dark stone walls. The Marquis held both the token and the crossbow, and he took care to walk, at all times, about 10 feet behind Hunter. Richard, in the lead, was carrying Hunter's beast spear, and a yellow flare the Marquis had produced from beneath his blanket, which illuminated the stone walls and the mud, and he walked well in front of Hunter. The marshland stank, and huge mosquitoes had begun to settle upon Richard's arms and legs and face, biting him painfully and raising huge, itching welts. Neither Hunter nor the Marquis had so much as mentioned the mosquitoes. Richard was beginning to suspect that they were quite lost. It did not help his mood any that there were a large number of dead people in the marsh, leathery preserved bodies, and discoloured skeletal bones, and pallid, water-swollen corpses. He wondered how long the corpses had been there, and whether they had been killed by the beast or by the mosquitoes. He said nothing as they walked on for another 5 minutes and 11 mosquito bites, and then he called out, "I think we're lost. We've been through this way before." The Marquis held up the token. "No, we're fine," he said. "The token is leading us straight. Clever little thing." "Yeah," said Richard, who was not impressed. "Very clever." It was then that the Marquis stepped, barefoot, on the shattered ribcage of a half-buried corpse, puncturing his heel and causing him to stumble. The little black statue went flying through the air and tumbled into the black marsh with the satisfied plop of a leaping fish returning to the water. The Marquis righted himself and pointed the crossbow at Hunter's back. He could feel warmth and a sharp pain in the heel of his right foot. He hoped he had not cut it too badly. He had little enough blood to spare anymore. "Richard," he called, "I dropped it. Can you come back here?" Richard walked back, holding the flare high, hoping for the glint of flame on obsidian, seeing nothing but wet mud. "Get down into the mud and look," said the Marquis. Richard groaned. "You've dreamed of the beast, Richard," said the Marquis. "Do you really want to encounter it?" Richard thought about this for not very long. Then he pushed the haft of the bronze spear into the surface of the marsh and stood the flare up into the mud beside it, illuminating the surface of the marsh with a fitful amber light, and he got down on his hands and knees in the bog, searching for the statue. He ran his hands over the surface of the marsh, hoping not to encounter any dead faces or hands. "It's hopeless. It could be anywhere." "Keep looking," said the Marquis. Richard tried to remember how he usually found things. First, he let his mind go as blank as he could. Then he let his gaze wander over the surface of the marsh, purposelessly, idly. Something glittered on the boggy surface 5 feet to his left. It was the beast statue. "I can see it," called Richard. He floundered towards it through the mud. The little glassy beast was head down in a puddle of dark water. Perhaps the mud was disturbed by Richard's approach. More likely, as Richard was convinced forever after, it was just the sheer cussedness of the material world. Whatever the cause, he was almost next to the little statue when the marsh made a noise that sounded like a giant stomach rumbling, and a large bubble of gas floated up and popped noxiously and obscenely beside the talisman, which vanished beneath the water. Richard reached the place where the talisman had been, and pushed his arms deep into the mud, searching for it wildly, not caring what else his fingers might encounter. It was no use. It was gone forever.
"What do we do now?" asked Richard.
The Marquis sighed.
"Get back over here, and we'll figure out something,"
Richard said quietly. "Too late." It was coming towards them so slowly, so ponderously, that he thought for a fragment of a second that it was old, sick, even dying. That was his first thought. And then he realized how much ground it was covering as it approached, mud and foul water splashing up from its hooves as it ran, and he realized how wrong he had been in thinking it slow. 30 feet away from them, the beast slowed and stopped with a grunt. Its flanks were steaming. It bellowed in triumph and in challenge. There were broken spears and shattered swords and rusted knives bristling from its sides and back. The yellow flare light glinted in its red eyes and on its tusks and its hooves. It lowered its massive head. It was some kind of boar, thought Richard, and then realized that that had to be nonsense. No boar could be so huge. It was the size of an ox, of a bull elephant, of a lifetime. It stared at them, and it paused for 100 years, which transpired in 12 heartbeats. Hunter knelt in one fluid motion and pulled up the spear from the Fleet Marsh, which released it with a sucking noise. And in a voice that was pure joy, she said, "Yes, at last." She had forgotten them all. Forgotten Richard down in the mud and the Marquis and his foolish crossbow and the world. She was delighted and transported in a perfect place, the world she lived for. Her world contained 2 things, Hunter and the Beast. The Beast knew that too. It was the perfect match, the hunter and the hunted, and who was who and which was which. Only time would reveal. Time and the dance. The Beast charged. Hunter waited until she could see the white spittle dripping from its mouth, and as it lowered its head, she stabbed up with the spear. But as she tried to sink the spear into its side, she understood that she had moved just a fraction of a second too late. And the spear went tumbling out of her numbed hands, and a tusk sharper than the sharpest razor blade opened her side. And as she fell beneath its monstrous weight, she felt its sharp hooves crushing down on her arm and her hip. And her ribs. And then it was gone, vanished back into the darkness, and the dance was done. Mr. Croup was more relieved than he would have admitted to be through the labyrinth, but he and Mr. Vandemar were through it, unharmed, as was their prey. There was a rock face in front of them, an oaken double door set in the rock face, and an oval mirror set in the right-hand door. Mr. Croup touched the mirror with one grimy hand. The surface of the mirror clouded at his touch, seethed for a moment, bubbling and roiling like a vat of boiling quicksilver, and then was still. The Angel Islington looked out at them. Mr. Croup cleared his throat.
"Ah, good morning, sir. It is us, and we have the young lady you sent us to fetch for you."
"And the key?" The angel's gentle voice seemed to come from all around them.
"Hanging around her swan-like neck," said Mr. Croup, a little more anxiously than he intended to.
"Then enter," said the angel. The oak doors swung open at his words, and they went in.